Okay, now you have some questions about it. Jason?
Even though, in that word, sort of start on the moment that they're happy, we can't even add up to 5 minutes, but we keep trying. Why are we so rich?
Okay, so why are we so dense that we keep trying to get happiness from the body when our whole experience is our whole lifetime, that it hasn't brought us any kind of lasting peace at all? This is the depth of the ignorance and the attachment. Yeah. Here we see just so clearly, why do we keep doing something that doesn't work again and again and again? Because our attachment makes us blind, and our ignorance makes us blind.
So
subtle. Yeah. Very subtle.
Sad.
Oh. Well, it's subtle and sad. I just can't be right. Okay. But it is. It's tremendously sad. It's very sad. When you look and you see all these people who have human bodies, but they don't have precious human lives. You know? And instead, the whole life is spent struggling for sex pleasure. Whole life. Struggling for sense play. It's very sad. Incredibly sad. Yeah?
Yeah, I was just gonna ask the body, like, right now it suffers because the mind is suffering. So an arhat and a bodhisattva and a Buddha there consider their sensation of the body
bliss. Okay, so then the body is suffering because the mind that lives in the body is suffering. So what about a Buddha or a Bodhisattva or an Arhat? Okay. It depends on the tenet school. But there's another quotation here. I'll just try to speak it clearly for us and be good. But the Theravadas say, yes, the body still suffers. Okay, but the Prasangika has a different view. Let me find that showcase. Hold on a second. Where did it go? I can't find it right now, of course. But the essence of the quotation was a bodhisattva, due to the power of their merit, doesn't have physical suffering. And due to the power of their wisdom, doesn't have mental suffering. But I think this is talking about an Arya Bodhisattva. Yeah. But then, the Arya Bodhisattvas, when they may have a flesh and bone body, when they realize emptiness, that life they realize emptiness. But after that, they're able to control their rebirth. And so, I don't know exactly if they, get born in a flesh and bone body or how exactly it works, But for them, at least after passing and above, there's not going to be the physical suffering. Yeah. But a lot of their, what they do is make emanations. Yeah. So, because the various bodhisattva, once your path is seen, you can make 100 emanations, and then second ground, 1,000 emanations. And so a lot of the what looks like a bodhisattva's body is actually an emanation. Yeah. And a Buddha doesn't have a flesh and bones body at all, period. Okay? So talking about, the Buddha having an experience of their body, it's going to be totally different because they don't have this kind of body. Because this kind of body is produced by karma and afflictions. Yeah?
What about
the
calling of human beings
that they
can manifest as human beings to benefit?
Yeah. So if you have a bodhisattva who's sending out an emanation, that emanation looks like a flesh and bones body, but that's done for the benefit of the sentient beings who whose minds they can subdue by appearing in that way. Okay, so they look like they have a flesh and bones body, but they don't.
The historical
Buddha, again, that's an emanation. It's called an emanation body specifically in the Manikaya. So it looks like a flesh and bone body. This is from the Prasangika view. From the view of the Theravada, the Buddha was an ordinary sentient being who was born with a flesh and bone body, you know, and then accomplished Buddhahood in that life. From the Mahayana viewpoint, even the historical Buddha was an emanation body. Was an appearance. An appearance of wisdom and compassion. Yeah. Okay, so from that viewpoint, the Buddha was enlightened before and appeared, you know, and went through this whole thing of, you know, taking birth and going to school and having problems with his mom and dad and the whole thing we go through and getting an education. And Buddha went through the whole thing as a way of making his example, making his life an example for us to learn how to practice from. Okay? But from the side of the Buddha, who's a fully enlightened one, you know, the Buddha didn't need to go to school and to do all those things, but it was done for our benefit, to show us, you know, what we need to put into our Dharma practice in order to get good results. Okay? So there's different ways of looking at the historical Buddha.
So, are there any examples of somebody who has
attained
Buddha?
Lots of examples of people who attained Buddha. Ben?
Like?
Milarepa?
So he was an ordinary human being.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But he didn't start the path just on that life as Milarepa. He had spent 500 lives prior to that doing a lot of serious practice. Yeah, but you can attain Buddhahood in a human body. Yeah?
At the beginning when you were talking about that, and looking back, if you could look back at your life and see yourself on the street model, and you used the term, it's so bad, so unfortunate that I didn't get over the hump of attachment. Obviously, something short of free of attachment, or, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, from a lay practitioner standpoint, like, what would be some clues or indications that you were that you were getting over the hump of attachment? Or is that just?
Do you really want me to answer that question?
No.
I think you know what the answer is.
Well, do you want me to hold that question for a while? I guess.
No, happy to answer. Yeah. I mean, when I was talking about the hump of attachment, yeah. And it is, because attachment is one of the big things that make Dharma practice difficult, isn't it? Yeah, wouldn't you say that attachment is more of a hindrance than anger is to Dharma practice? You know, I mean, anger is a problem in our life and it creates discord and everything. But is it anger or attachment that keeps you really from practicing? Mostly. Yeah? It's usually attachment, isn't it?
Anger makes me seek
the
Dharma.
Yeah, the discomfort from anger makes you seek the Dharma. But it's attachment that prevents you from getting to the teachings or going on retreat or getting to the meditation cushion or something like that. You know, you don't say, I'm so angry tonight, I can't go to Dharma class. Yeah? So it's usually something else that has to do with attachment that creates the block for us. Yeah? So I would say that when we see in our life some ability to overcome more attachment or deal with our attachment, that as we see that ability growing, I would say that that's a sign that you're making some progress.
Yeah, I mean, progress, I guess I was hung up on the over the hump part. Like, I mean, progress, you make progress on both sides of that hump. Because there's all kinds of signs and marks of the Buddha and everything like that, you know, and you hear about that for the Bodhisattva levels and all that. But for lay practitioners, you know, they don't have those sort of, like, demarcations, you know?
Yeah. Okay, well, my opinion is when, as a lay practitioner, when you get over that hump, is when you want to ordain. Why do you have to ask that question? Anyway.
That right there speaks to my attachment, you know. Yeah. As much as my heart wants to embrace that, I could still kind of have a little effort and it's like, oh, there's all the things that I'm going to be attached to, I'm going to renounce, you know. I'm going to let them go. You know, I'm not ready to
play. Yeah. So we see how we get a little skittish, don't we? But we forget that we're renouncing suffering. And we think we're renouncing happiness, but we're renouncing suffering.
Mm-hmm. Well, so if you ordain,
if
you choose to ordain, you're still walking, right? You're still a pastor. Oh, sure. You still ordain to get away from those things, but not hunting
all the time. Okay, so what's the role of ordination in dealing with the attachment? When you ordain, you have a certain level of awareness of these things are not going to make me happy, and in fact they're binding me to samsara. And then you see, depending where you are, yeah, sometimes, I mean, very high practitioners also see these things are just totally disgusting. I really don't want to have anything to do with them. Okay, but most of us who ordain are not at that level yet, and most of us see, oh, when I get attached, I get totally hooked in and lost. Yeah? You get hooked in and lost when you're attached? I get hooked in and lost. And you see that, and you say, you know, the more I get hooked in and lost with my attachment, you know, it's impeding me from making some spiritual progress. Yeah, so it's impeding me from actualizing my spiritual aspirations. And yet, at the same time, you see how your mind is just totally out of control with objects of attachment. So you realize you need some discipline. So that you take precepts, because the precepts protect you. Yeah, you have seen with wisdom that, you know, I don't want to do those things. But you also know you have a lot of attachment for them. Yeah? And so you say, you know, it's not suppressing, it's not negating human desires or any of that kind of stuff. It's just saying, my mind gets out of control and I need some discipline to stop my mind from doing that. And so there's some things that I need to keep some space from, because my mind is so uncontrolled that the attachment just goes bonkers. Okay? So the precepts protect you from doing what you don't want to do anyway, even though the attachment part of you wants to do it. Okay? Right?
Like the body is kind of a vehicle to inspire you to be compassionate, right? If I think of a doctor in a hospital helping sick patients, mm-hmm. That's inspiring. I mean, that's a good thing. And mm-hmm. So while, you know, I can say, yeah, suffering exists and isn't it sad to see all these sick people, if I look at the doctor instead of the sick people, it looks like we're a compassionate group of folks here on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just kind of stuck, struck by this conversation that's been kind of unsettling about okay, yeah, I get that the body suffers and I get that we're all going to die, but there's a huge opportunity to be compassionate because we're aware of what the body feels.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the body suffers. It's going to get sick and die and old. And within that, you know, we show compassion to each other. Yeah. So doctors show compassion to patients. Caregivers show compassion to whoever. Parents try and keep their kids healthy. Yeah, we show compassion very much in relationship to our body. Yeah. To help sentient beings who have the first kind of dukkha, the ouch, the pain, that dukkha. Okay, let's sit quietly.